But under current laws and regulations, the mining industry has been given a pass when it comes to mining on dry land.
A lawsuit aims to stop pebble mine exploration. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 29th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, flooding leads to voluntary evacuations and closed roads near Seward.
The waterfall's coming down at a pretty good clip, so they've closed the road there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
Trustees for Alaska filed a lawsuit in Anchorage Superior Court this morning, challenging all of the state's permits that allow exploration of the proposed pebble mine in the Bristol Bay region. Steve Cotton is executive director for trustees. He says the law firm is also seeking an injunction to halt exploration activity until the court reaches a decision. The lawsuit alleges the state violated the Alaska Constitution by not giving meaningful notice to the public about the proposed permits and allowing public input. Exhibit 1 in the lawsuit is the state's online notice for the current exploration permit.
It's the one and only notice the state has ever provided for 21 years of exploration at Pebble. And it doesn't even mention the Pebble mine. You could stare at it for a day and not know it's about Pebble.
Cotton says the lawsuit is coming now after years of exploration because the level of activity has ramped up and Bristol Bay residents are at a breaking point. He says current activities allowed under the 2009-2010 permit include drilling 425 boreholes up to 7,000 feet deep.
They can dig 320 test pits and set 220,000 feet of seismic lines along which explosions are set off. They can put helicopters in the air 24/7, making hundreds of trips per season. And they can withdraw tens of millions of gallons of water from streams and ponds in the area without even knowing if there are fish in the waters that they're pumping from. That's a lot of impact.
Cotton says no oil or mining company would be able to engage in this level of activity without public notice if it were offshore in state tidewater.
But under current laws and regulations, the mining industry has been given a pass when it comes to mining on dry land. Exploration permits like those for Pebble are handed out essentially behind closed doors. No public notice, no chance for the public to express their views, no analysis of the public interest.
One of the original architects of the Alaska Constitution, Vic Fisher, is on the list of plaintiffs, along with former First Lady Bella Hammond, who lives in the region, and Nunumta Iluxtai, a nonprofit with 8 Native village corporations from the Bristol Bay area. Bobby Andrews is the spokesman. He says people in his region have found out about activity at the Pebble Prospect through newspaper and broadcast stories. He says internet connections are marginal in Bristol Bay, and many don't have computers.
We need to be aware long before it even becomes public in order for us to make our public statements as to where we stand on the positions that we need to take in order to protect the renewable resources as well as protecting the water.
Mike Heatwall is a spokesman for the Pebble Partnership. He says current activity at the Pebble site is actually down from years past. He says all the work that's been conducted has been in an open way that is being monitored by the state.
These permits are publicly available, as are the State Department Natural Resource Inspection reports. There's several on their website, I think many of which were cited in today's briefing. And so from a public, awareness of what's going on at Pebble, there's no mysteries about our activity and what we're doing.
Heatwall says exploration work can involve 30 to 50 people if there is drilling activity and 20 plus support staff in less active times. He says Pebble Partnership is a long way from mining for gold.
We haven't even brought forward a development plan, which would be subject to a very, very rigorous and public process through NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which has three very specific public notice and public hearing requirements that go through it.
It's not known when the judge will rule on the permit question or the request for an injunction. State Department of Natural Resources Mining Coordinator for Pebble, Tom Crayford, says state officials have not yet reviewed the suit and can't comment, but he says these types of permits are revocable at will, and there is no public notice requirement attached to them. More information on the suit is at our website, aprn.org. Parts of the Kenai Peninsula are experiencing flooding rivers and waterways as seasonal snow and glacier melt combine with a couple days of consistent rainfall. Residents in one area near Seward are being asked to prepare for evacuation. Some have already left. An incident command held a meeting this afternoon. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
Rising water from the Resurrection River out of Box Canyon near Seward is endangering roads and bridges. A flood warning has been issued for urban areas and small streams in western Prince William Sound. The National Weather Service expects the stream levels to rise slowly, but already Exit Glacier Road near Seward had water flowing over it and needed to be closed. Alaska Parks has shut down the Exit Glacier area of Kenai Fjords National Park. Sue Wilcox is special assistant to Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Dave Carey and acting spokeswoman for the Borough Emergency Management Department. She was at the incident command meeting and says there are conjoined Seward City roads and borough roads.
Some of the roads and the bridges are in danger of the rise of the water, and some of them are being eaten away on the outside, and levees are being compromised. And so we need to work together, and we're forming a plan together to address all the different aspects of this event.
Wilcox says if they get a failed levee back in place and they can keep Exit Glacier Road from deteriorating further, a door-to-door notification of residents in Old Exit Glacier subdivision advised them to consider voluntary evacuation.
The Bear Creek Fire Department has gone door-to-door and has notified every resident that a voluntary evacuation was in place. Most of the people have elected to leave, but troopers and Bear Creek are monitoring the situation and they're handling all of that for us.
The Seward City Clerk, Jean Lewis, says things might sound more dramatic than they are. Inside the city, the scene has been normal, but outside the city, Lowell Point Road has been closed near the waterfall bridge because of damage from heavy rain. Lewis says people there are adjusting.
And the waterfall's coming down at a pretty good clip, so they've closed the road there. And we're ferrying people. I think Miller's Landing is, and some other people are taking people, you know, if they're stranded out at Lowell Point or need to get into town to work and whatnot, taking them back and forth on the water taxi.
The Department of Transportation issued an advisory to avoid the Seward Highway near Seward. Flooding was reported between milepost 0 and 7, but Lewis says the levels there have already diminished slightly.
It floods right there about mile 3. And it is up onto right coming across the bike path in a spot or two. But I was kind of pleased to see that it wasn't higher than that. So right now it's looking fine from here to mile 7.
At the same time, Lewis says weather can change quickly. Wilcox says the incident command has been reviewing the forecast and also says there is a bit of a lull right now. The priority is rebuilding the levee. For the central Kenai Peninsula, a flood advisory is in effect because of rainfall, but also because of a glacial dam outburst. Skelak Lake appears to be releasing water, making for high levels on the Kenai River. People near the lake in the Kenai Keys and in Soldotna in the Big Eddy area are asked to take action and protect life and property. Heavy rains have also caused a rock slide at the mouth of a small rail tunnel north of Seward. The Alaska Railroad Corporation is providing motor coach transportation between Anchorage and Seward through Friday. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
The country's biggest wildfire is getting larger by the day. The Minto South Flats blaze west of Nenana has burned 337,000 acres. Fire Information Officer Sarah Sarlos says part of the acreage increase is attributable to better mapping, but that activity has been extreme due to days of fire-conducive weather.
We've been having abnormally high temperatures, wind every day, strong south-southeast winds that we've been getting, and the humidities have been 30 or below.
Meanwhile, state and federal firefighters responded to 6 new interior wildfires yesterday, including 5 human-caused blazes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an icebreaker mission into uncharted Arctic waters.
We have better maps of the moon than we do our own ocean floor.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski today asked the federal government to send its own staff to help seniors and disabled people who are shut out of the personal care and Medicaid waiver assistance programs. The Department of Health and Human Services ordered the state to no longer accept new applications from the public until a backlog of nearly 2,000 people needing aid is cleared up. Specifically, Murkowski asked for public health doctors, nurses, and other professionals to help in the state. She says HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius promised to take the request under consideration.
We recognize that, if we were to just move to lift the moratorium but not address the issue of the fact that you can't get through this backlog because you don't have enough professionals to do the assessments, we really haven't helped Alaskans.
Governor Sean Parnell says the federal moratorium is a concern to him and Health and Social Services Commissioner Bill Hogan. It was a major topic of discussion at his cabinet meeting today, and Parnell says his administration is looking for qualified people to help clear up the backlog.
We have the money to do it. We just don't have the positions filled or the ability to fill those positions quickly. At least we haven't in the past. And Commissioner Hogan is working hard to A, either fill those positions, or B, contract out the ability to do these reassessments in a quicker fashion.
The state has hired a project manager to direct the efforts to regain federal recognition. It has also opened up the requirements for hiring new health condition assessors. The job is no longer limited only to nurses. Social workers and other people trained in health management may now apply. 12 positions are now listed on the Workplace Alaska website. Senator Murkowski has asked the Senate Indian Affairs Committee to hold a hearing this fall on the Native American 8A program. It gives Alaska Native corporations advantages so they can net high-value government contracts. The Small Business Administration program, and specifically the Alaska Native Corporation contracts, came under scrutiny earlier this month at a Senate Contracting Oversight Subcommittee hearing chaired by Missouri Democrat Senator Claire McCaskill. In a press release, Murkowski called the subcommittee hearing a hostile environment for the Native corporations. She wants the Indian Affairs panel to hear their side of the story. Murkowski sits on that committee. The U.S. and Canada are gearing up for a joint mission into ice-filled Arctic waters. Next week, both nations will send an icebreaker ship north into the Beaufort Sea, where they'll meet up and map the Arctic. They'll work together, but as APRN's Libby Casey reports, the data may eventually help each nation lay competing claims to the resource-rich seabed.
The ships are headed for icy waters so far north and hard to reach that it's basically uncharted territory, according to the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Captain Steve Barnum directs NOAA's Office of Coast Survey and says they know little about that part of the world.
The information we have is from the early explorers, the best information we have, but the tools that they're going to be using up there in the scientific expedition is to give us new insight into what the bottom of the seafloor looks like. We have better maps of the moon than we do our own ocean floor.
The two icebreakers, one from the U.S. and one from Canada, leave northern ports in their home countries on August 7th and will rendezvous a few days later, 200 miles offshore in the Beaufort Sea. For over a month, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Healy and the Canadian Coast Guard ship Louis S. Saint Laurent will travel in tandem, taking turns breaking through the ice. The Healy will use sonar to map the sea floor, while the Louis S. Saint Laurent will collect seismic data. U.S. senior State Department official Maggie Hayes says they'll share everything they learn.
With each country's ship using its particular capabilities to focus on a different aspect of collecting data, each nation obtains more data than either could collect alone.
Hayes says the main mission is to find the edge of the continental shelf off Alaska. While the nations will share their data, what they eventually do with it is entirely up to them. The Law of the Sea Treaty gives countries the right to file claims about where their northern boundaries lie. Canada accepted the treaty in 2003, but the U.S. is the only major industrialized nation that has not signed on. Maggie Hayes says President Obama is strongly in favor of becoming party to the convention. The Senate must vote on it, so Hayes says the State Department is in touch with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and hopes it could move this year, although Hayes says she can't really predict what will happen. In the meantime, other countries are moving forward, filing their Arctic Sea claims. Hayes says there are now over 50 submissions.
We do expect to become party to the Law of the Sea Convention very soon. It's true that we are somewhat behind other countries that had joined the convention earlier. We will be obviously at the end of the line, and that is disadvantageous to us.
But Hayes says, in the meantime, the U.S. can collect data, prepare its information, and be ready to file claims when the Law of the Sea Treaty is ratified. The U.S.-Canadian icebreaker partnership is in its second year, and representatives from both countries are focusing on their unity. But they aren't throwing open the books. Data gathered by the U.S. Navy and its submarines won't be shared with Canada as it prepares to make its claims. And it is conceivable that the information gathered next month will at some point lead the two nations to stake out overlapping areas. They already dispute a wedge in the Beaufort Sea, directly north of Alaska and the Yukon Territory, with rich oil and gas potential. Next month's trip is time to take advantage of the season's warmest conditions, so sea ice will be at its lowest annual point. The Arctic had its biggest melt on record two summers ago. Maggie Hayes says global warming is actually helping with the mapping.
You know, I think all of us are very regretful about the loss of ice cover, but it has facilitated the collection of this data.
That melt is making the Arctic more and more desirable for its shipping lanes and untapped oil and gas. But even if the ice recedes and the sea is more open than usual, this will be no easy trip. Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Kenneth Boda just got off another U.S. icebreaker and says multi-year ice can stop a ship the size of the Healy.
You can get ice ridges up to 30 feet thick, and that would present a challenge for any ship to get through, even a very heavy icebreaker. As this ice is shifting around up there, you can't really say where it's going to be. You can look at the satellite images and get a decent idea, but as you go, it's sometimes you run into stuff that you didn't expect.
Canadian officials say there's always the risk that the special seismic instruments their ship tows will get damaged or caught up in the craggy ice, but they say that's a good reason to travel with a fellow vessel. Officials from both countries say neither could do the mission alone, since they don't have the new polar-class icebreakers to rival the Russians. However, they say by working together, the Canadians and Americans should be able to bring back compelling new data. The August icebreaker trip will be documented on the U.S. website, continentalshelf.gov. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Villages and cities across Alaska are receiving more than $5 million in federal stimulus money for police services. The announcement came yesterday that public safety grants would be available through the U.S. Department of Justice. Police departments receiving the grants will be required to keep the officers on the job for 4 years. In Alaska, 11 rural villages and Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Sitka were awarded grants. Anchorage gets the lion's share, more than $2.5 million. Dave Parker is an Anchorage Police Department spokesman.
The grant itself was for either the retention of officers or hiring of new officers, that it would probably be used to retain officers. We all understand that Anchorage is in some pretty difficult situations, where finances are concerned. And so we want to assure that we have officers who are trained, available to do the job.
Parker says it takes 9 months to train an APD officer, so it may take a while before new officers are on the street. He says it's not certain yet when the money will be available. Meanwhile, the news took the native community of Akyachak by surprise. Business manager Jonathan Lomax said he had not heard of the award. Akyachak is set to receive more than $163,000 in police grant money. The grants will provide 100% funding for salaries and benefits for newly hired officers or for the rehiring of officers formerly laid off due to local city budget cuts. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has distributed nearly $3 million to Alaskans who lost their homes and other property in the devastating spring floods. In all, families in 22 villages on the Yukon and Kuskokwim were impacted. The deadline for applying for federal assistance is August 10th. With a maximum grant of $30,300. Jack Heesch is an external affairs officer for FEMA. He says the agency has had to test out some unique ideas in Alaska.
Once you get outside of the rail belt and you get into places like Eagle and Stevens Village and Tanana, well, you can't run down to the Home Depot and pick up the materials you need. And so what we did was we have people who are receiving payments from us under the individual household program, and they're using that to buy materials, to order the materials from wherever they may come. And then FEMA is actually paying for the transportation of that. By way of example, this last week we had a barge full of stuff that came from Nenana. I mean, the barge was loaded at Nenana with insulation, plywood, tools, food, water, you name it. And that shipped, first dropped off at Tanana, and then went on to Stevens Village and dropped off all the materials they need there. Well, FEMA's paying for all that transportation. The individuals themselves, with the grants they get, for the most part, are paying for those orders.
On a yearly basis, how does what happened in Alaska compare to the work that FEMA does in other states for forest fires or flooding damage? How big is this event that happened here in Alaska compared to what you do annually?
Well, when we look at the number, for instance, as of this morning, we've had 629 people register in all of Alaska for this disaster. Now, let me tell you, for those 629 people, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. And it is, in fact, a disaster for them. I've worked on disasters where we had as many as 10,000 people a day registering. But then when you look at the uniqueness of Alaska and our ability to be able to get assistance to those people, it's a very different, much more complex kind of a mission that we have here.
What would you say FEMA has learned from much larger disasters, such as Hurricane Katrina, that is helping with this rebuilding process in Alaska?
I think over the last several years, what we've seen with FEMA is a much more forward-leaning. We have two full-time employees in Alaska. We brought in another five or six folks, and we were actually in the State Emergency Operations Center every day with the state, tracking what was going on. And mostly that was, for us, maintaining situational awareness so that we knew what was going on, so that we could start thinking about what are we going to do about housing. If this all starts to shake out like it looks like it's going to, if the stuff that's happening in Eagle starts to happen downriver, if the stuff that's happening upriver in the Cusco starts happening further down the Kuskokwim, so there's a whole lot more anticipation in some ways, and that allows us to respond more quickly.
And after the August 10th deadline, what happens then? It's a matter of just continuing on the work that's been started now?
Oh, yeah.
To completion.
Once the deadline comes and goes, the only thing that does is it means we won't get any more registrations.
Sure.
The truth of the matter is that of the 600 folks or so who have registered, something less than half of them have been approved for some kind of funding, whether it's household or other needs. There's a number that have been deemed ineligible for one reason or another. We've got people sitting in a room and inspectors out in the field all trying to sort that stuff out to make sure Certainly that people get what they deserve, but then the flip side of that is, you know, our job is partly to protect the American taxpayer because we can't appear to be, or we shouldn't be, wasteful in terms of how we give those that support out. So it's kind of a hard process, and I'm pretty certain that the folks that are working in that office are going to be around for a couple more months anyway.
Jack Heesch is an external affairs officer for FEMA in Alaska. State biologists say fishing restrictions on the Yukon River appear to be working and expect that enough Canada-bound king salmon will make it to their spawning grounds. Canadian stocks account for about 50% of the Yukon River Chinook, and their numbers are low. Regional Fisheries Supervisor John Linderman says the restrictions, including reduced subsistence fishing time, were aimed at meeting minimum escapement goals as measured at the Yukon River sonar at Eagle.
The actions that were taken this year of not fishing on that first pulse of Chinook salmon, which is where we see the majority of those Canadian stocks within the entire run, it's still yet to be seen how well that strategy played out. But so far at the Eagle Sonar Project, which determines how many fish we get across the border, it's looking fairly good.
Alaska is required to meet minimum goals under an agreement with Canada. It's unclear why Canadian king stocks have been weak. Linderman says the parent year runs were strong.
Those were pretty good runs. In fact, 2003, we saw one of the highest Canadian escapements in that year in the past 10 to 15 years. So all three of those parent years, and especially 2003, were good runs where we achieved escapement goals throughout the drainage. So seeing these poor returns, it certainly raises questions on exactly what caused that, especially because it's just those Canadian stocks.
The Canadian Yukon River Chinook aren't the only king stocks that have been low in Alaska this summer. Several other river systems are also experiencing poor king runs. State Commercial Fisheries Director John Hilsinger says kings may be more susceptible to environmental effects.
Chinook spend more time in the ocean than many of the other species. It's not uncommon to see Chinook that spend 5 years in the ocean, so potentially they would have a longer period of time there and potentially more sources of mortality.
Many people are pointing to Chinook bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery, but Hilsinger says that doesn't account for enough of the missing fish. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Kenai and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.